and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast here in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa on this Friday, January 10, 2025. Stakeholders at the Kenyan-brokered South Sudan peace talks continue to wait for the government delegation to arrive from Juba. And President-elect Donald Trump will be sworn in January 20th as the only U.S. president with felony convictions. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Delegates at the South Sudan talks in Nairobi say they are waiting for South Sudan government at the talks, at the venue of the talks in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A leader of a holdout group at the talks told VOA Thursday South Sudan government should honor its pledges to the South Sudanese people. Quel is with the People's Coalition for Civic Action. He has been waiting at the South Sudan talks, at the venue of the South Sudan talks since January 6. We now go live to Quel in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. We'll bring that story to you once he is ready. Donald Trump will be sworn in January 20th as the only U.S. president with felony convictions. And this week saw a series of activity over court cases still open against him. On Friday, a New York judge sentenced Trump in one of the cases. Trump, who will be starting his second term in the White House, was given unconditional discharge, which means the felony conviction stands, but there will be no jail term or fine. The judge said he did not want to interfere with the presidency. Trump and his attorney were not in the courtroom and attended by a video link. He claimed he's innocent and called the case a very terrible experience and repeated his claims that he was very, very unfairly treated. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Presitti brings us the latest.
President-elect Donald Trump had gone through every appeal and even petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to block sentencing in his highest-profile court case. But late Thursday, the High Court rejected his request to delay sentencing. The once-and-future president was found guilty last year of 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide hush money payments to a porn star.
This was a disgrace.
Political analysts like Shannon Bowe O'Brien of the University of Texas say this case was personal to Trump.
He doesn't like to admit fault. He doesn't like to admit weaknesses or shortcomings.
New York Supreme Court Judge Juan Merchan, who presided over the trial, had denied a delay, but also said he would not sentence the former president to jail. Gary Rose teaches politics at Sacred Heart University.
I think the message that really is conveyed here is that no one is above the law. And that the process has played out and it's going to now bring, you know, it's going to bring it to an end.
In a second and third case, a Trump-appointed judge this week temporarily blocked the Justice Department from releasing final reports from special counsel Jack Smith. The cases, both dismissed, involve the storage of classified documents and election interference with the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. This week, the president-elect reiterated his belief that Smith was appointed illegally.
He was thrown off the case in disgrace. Why should he be allowed to write a fake report? It'll only be a fake report.
Special counsels are required to file summary reports. The U.S. Attorney General said he would release Smith's report on the January 6th uprising at the Capitol. Making that public could hamper Trump's efforts to pardon those arrested. Again, Professor O'Brien.
If a lot of this comes to light, that a lot of this was planned and a lot of this, these activities were malicious and they were criminal, he is giving people a free pass on criminal activity.
The fourth case deals with Georgia election interference. The prosecutor was removed due to an improper romantic relationship with an employee. So the case is at a standstill until it is dismissed or until another prosecutor is assigned. Again, Professor Rose.
I think the voters are actually hoping that this whole thing is brought to an end, and that now we can begin anew with a second Trump term.
And that term starts on Monday, January 20th.
It feels great.
Carolyn Frasutti, VOA News.
And still on Trump, political observers and commentators are debating how Donald Trump's second term in office in the White House will affect U.S. relations with Egypt, which prospered during his first presidential term. Neither President Barack Obama nor Joe Biden invited Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to the White House, while Trump invited him twice. Al-Sisi has said he hopes Trump's second term will provide mutual benefit for both countries and promote peace and stability in the region. Ambassador Ayman Zain al-Din, former director of the media department at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi what Trump's re-election could bring to bilateral relations.
First of all, there is a high degree of uncertainty about what the new second presidency of Donald Trump bring to the American policy in general, in different regions, different files, including, of course, that bilateral relations between Egypt and the United States. So there is hope, of course. Every new beginning brings some hope with it, but the amount of uncertainty is affecting that. Let me also say quickly that there is a significant difference between Egyptian-American relations during Trump's first term and this current term. First of all, the issues of a change inside Egypt, democracy, human rights, that kind of thing used to be paramount during the years that preceded and within which President Trump resumed office last time. Those matters have become really very far in the background in international relations and in U.S. foreign policy, not just with Trump, but even with the presidency of outgoing President Biden. So that's one area where change has been dramatic in the context. Also, economic issues in Egypt have changed and have become more complicated compared to where they were a few years ago. But thirdly, and more importantly, most importantly, is what's happening strategically in the region after more than 1 year of war in Gaza, what's happening in Lebanon, Syria, with Iran. The whole regional balance of power has become completely different in a much more dangerous state of affairs compared to where it was. And I have to say, in all honesty, this is how the whole region views it, I guess. It had a lot to do with President Trump, the way he handled the Israeli-Arab conflict, shifting it towards the Abrahamic Accords at the expense of resolving the Palestinian question, in fact, recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the whole of Jerusalem and the annexation of the Golan Heights. So it is a completely different regional context, and this is something that we have to be quite aware of concerning the future of Egyptian-American relations.
With President-elect Trump focus on America first, how would that impact the strategic cooperation between Washington and Cairo?
This is an important question. From the point of view of Egypt, the relations with the United States has always been transactional. Ever since the beginning of quote-unquote peacemaking after the 1973 war. So this transactional nature of relations, basically Egypt delivering on achieving peace and normalization between Israel and Egypt and with the rest of the region, that was the hope, at least, America would provide support for Egypt. So that was a transactional relationship in which America first, or what America wants coming first, is not shocking to us if you compare that to the kind of alliance the United States has with Western Europe, with East Asia, countries of East Asia like Japan and Korea, or even with Israel, where the relationship is built on more than just transactional interests. There, the effects of America First policy might have an impact, at least for Europe and Asia. But for Egypt, this is not a shock. This is not something new. Let me tell you how the thinking is in Egypt. I think the question now is not so much what could Trump do to Egypt, but more what can Egypt do to influence Trump in a way that his regional policy would be more constructive to how to make him realize that the current state of affairs is so dangerous, so fraught, that if we continue to see the current trends continue for the next 5 years, we will see a completely changed situation in the the region a very damaging one, where, of course, the interests of the countries of the region will be preeminently affected, but also America's interests will be tremendously affected, because this is a very threatening state of affairs. So this has to be reversed. So this is what is concerning, I think, the thinking in Egypt up in the highest circles of government. This is also an educated speculation and not a whim.
That was Ambassador Ayman Zain al-Din, former director of media department at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, speaking with VOA's analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanari. We now go back to our South Sudan story. Delegates at the South Sudan talks in Nairobi say they are waiting for the South Sudan government at the venue of the talks, which was scheduled to kick off on Monday. A leader of a holdout group at the talks told VOA Thursday the South Sudan government should honor its pledges to the South Sudanese people. Quel Aguer Quel is with the People's Coalition for Civic Action. He has been waiting at the venue of the talks since January 6. We now go live to Quel in Nairobi. Good evening.
Good evening, John.
Yeah, talk to us about what is happening in Nairobi. It's my understanding you have been waiting since Monday for the government delegation so that you can resume or start negotiations.
Yeah, nothing is happening, actually, because what we agreed or what was made by the mediation and the government, they agreed that the talks should resume on the 6th of this month. And it was repeated by the president in his New Year address. Unfortunately, until now, there is no clear information whether the government is coming or not coming. So we are still waiting, and we don't have concrete information from the government to the mediation of when are they expected to come or they are not coming. There is no clear information.
And what were you supposed to do if the government delegation was to come on time on January 6? What were you supposed to do? What was the task on your to-do list?
According to the mediation and opposition and stakeholders, we were supposed to finalize the outstanding protocol on governance and responsibility sharing, because that was the topic that was left when the government went to Juba in September 2024 for consultation. Unfortunately, when the new team came back, they showed that they were not interested to agree with the protocol that was signed, and they were completely asking for something different. They were saying that there shouldn't be any mention of any statement that are mentioned in a revitalized agreement in the new agreement. There should be separate agreements. And when the mediation suggested that we should try to make the new agreement to supplement the air access, the government took the paper and went to Juba for consultation, and up to now, there is no response from them. So we don't know whether they are coming to negotiate a new agreement, what they call supplementary agreement to air access, or are they coming to start from where we stopped? Because that was not resolved last time when they left Nairobi.
And you are in you are at the venue of the talks representing the people in South Sudan. The civil society speaks on behalf of the people. With all this happening, how do you predict the outcome of these talks?
The outcome is really not clear, because the government is not interested any longer into mining. Because I think the reason why they came to Kenya for help last time was the fact that they knew they were not going to conduct elections, and therefore the extension was not going to be possible. But since they have secured the extension of government for 2 years, the current team particularly feel that there is no need for any agreement because they have secured the extension. So it is just a matter of diplomatic game, but I don't think there is a strategic decision for the government to go for a sustainable peace in the country.
And then
the current agreement, gives them power in Article 8.4 to extend it as long as possible. So this is a tragedy.
Yeah, you're entitled to your prediction, but the government is not on this interview or on this call. Why would you say they are not serious?
The government are not serious because if they were serious, they were supposed to come back on the 6th. And if there is any reason that has delayed them, they should actually communicate officially to the mediation that we have a reason that is delaying us and we will be coming in this time. So that is why I'm saying they're not serious, because if you fail to turn up on agreed time, you have obligation to communicate the reason why you are delaying to the mediation and to the people of South Sudan, because people of South Sudan were told that the government will go back on the 6th. So long as they have turned up, they have not turned up, and they have not communicated neither to mediation nor the people of South Sudan, they are breaking their promises silently without communicating to anybody.
And what is your reaction to development yesterday where four holdout groups formed a new alliance, and you were all invited to the Tumaini talks in your capacity? Like you were there for the People's Coalition for Civic Action, and the others were there in their own capacity. But now there is a new kid on the block. What is your reaction to this development?
I think that development is positive, because in the state of all the factions negotiating alone, it will be good for them to have a common objective and common vision for the country than individual organization negotiating alone. So to us, we think that is positive, because this country needs a unity of people. We need a unity of those who are opposing the government to present a clear picture of where do they want to take the country to as an opposition, instead of being individual group with a different objective and different vision for the country. So I think that is a positive step.
And the civil society stands in between the government and the holdout groups, given the situation right now where you have been waiting for 4 days for the government delegation to come so that you can resume talks. What is the solution that the civil society has in its toolbox to, if you like, bring the parties together to resume negotiations?
The civil society and non-political actors are very much concerned about the delay of the talks and the delay of concluding the peace, because people are suffering in the country. People are going to 13 months without salary, and all the social services will stop because the teachers, the health workers cannot continue to go to work without being paid. And above all, there are no medical drugs or medicine in the medical facility. So the whole thing is going towards the collapse of the system, because the government is not doing its duty. So we are very much concerned about the delay We are very much concerned about suffering of the country, and we are very much concerned about the collapse of our country on earth.
All right, Quayle Aguer. Quayle, thank you very much for speaking to us about the situation at the venue of the talks in Nairobi.
Thank you.
That was Quayle Aguer, a member of the People's Coalition for Civic Action, speaking to me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the killing of journalists in Gaza and Haiti in recent weeks underscores dangers of media. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands. That is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay artwork.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The killing of journalists in Gaza and Haiti in recent weeks underscores the dangers media confront. Analysts say war, instability and lack of accountability contributed to deadly year for the media, with more than 100 killed in 2024. Press Freedom editor Jessica Jarrett has the story.
Gunfire in Haiti turns what should have been a good news story into a tragedy for the country's press. The attack came as journalists gathered for the reopening of Port-au-Prince's largest medical centre in late December. It highlights the risks Haitian media confront daily. Jean Fagan Rigala is a photojournalist who was at the hospital that day.
I was looking at the wall next to me and I could see the bullets hitting it. It was a terrible experience. A few minutes later, I saw journalists coming towards us inside with gunshot wounds.
The violence left two journalists dead, including Makenda Natu, a freelance journalist who did marketing for VOA's Creole service. He is one of more than a dozen journalists killed in the country in the past 2 years, says Guy Delva of the Haitian organisation SOS Journaliste.
Working conditions for journalists in Haiti are very dangerous, very challenging, and because you're living in a country where everything is possible. Journalists can be killed, can be wounded when you less expect it.
In the same week in Gaza, an Israeli strike hit this vehicle, killing 5 Palestinian journalists. Israel says it targeted a group of militants, but watchdogs say the vehicle was clearly marked as press. The journalists' names have been added to the list of casualties in what was a deadly year globally for media. More than 100 journalists and media workers were killed in 2024, according to data from the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. Most were Palestinians who died covering the Israel-Hamas war. The loss of local media workers affects how that conflict is covered, CPJ says. Jody Ginsberg is the CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
They're also the only people able to report from Gaza because no foreign journalists have been allowed in. So they bear the full weight of responsibility of reporting on the impact of the war on Gaza.
Pakistan too saw a surge in violence directed at media. Local watchdogs document at least a dozen journalists slain. Analysts say the attacks are linked to the political turmoil and security situation. But while instability adds to the risks, Delva of SOS Journaliste says it is at those times that audiences need the media most.
So I think journalists can help build democracy, and they have to help build democracy and allow people to enjoy human rights.
With media an increasingly risky field to work in, watchdogs say accountability for attacks like those seen in 2024 is one way to keep journalists safe. Jessica Dorit, VOA News.
6 days of official funeral ceremonies honoring the life and the legacy of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter concluded in his home state of Georgia, where VOA's Ken Farabwa has more.
In a rare moment uniting all five living presidents, the country said goodbye to the 39th president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, in official state ceremonies at the National Cathedral in Washington. President Joe Biden delivered the eulogy for a man he has known since supporting his 1976 campaign for the presidency.
I was the first senator outside of Georgia, maybe the first senator, to endorse his candidacy for president. It was an endorsement based on what I believe is Jimmy Carter's enduring attribute, character.
The son of President Gerald Ford, Carter's Republican rival for the White House in 1976, also delivered a eulogy his late father wrote to honor his successor.
Honesty and truth-telling were synonymous with the name Jimmy Carter.
Jason Carter paid tribute to his grandfather's legacy as the founder of the nonprofit Carter Center, which fights disease, builds hope, and wages peace around the world.
Essentially, he eradicated a disease with love and respect. He waged peace with love and respect. He led this nation with love and respect.
A somber day that began in Washington ended in Carter's home state of Georgia, which welcomed him back on a final journey home to the town of Plains.
Because this little town shaped him.
Dot Padgett, who worked on Jimmy Carter's Peanut Brigade of volunteers in his 1976 campaign for the White House, joined hundreds lining the streets of Plains to say goodbye to the man who was more than a former president to them.
I've spent a lot of time with Rosalind and Jimmy in this town, and I am so grateful that at this date and this time that I can be back and be with the family.
President Carter put Plains in the spotlight for most of his life, and his final journey through the town he called home for a century attracted media and visitors from around the world.
It is a sad occasion, and America and the world will be less well off because of the passing of Jimmy Carter.
Former member of the Parliament of the United Kingdom, Sir Simon Burns, traveled from England to say goodbye to his friend, Jimmy Carter.
I think as the casket passed, the finality of the situation really struck home. This was the last time we were going to see President Carter.
Following a private funeral service at Maranatha Baptist Church, Jimmy Carter's hearse made one last procession through Plains, taking his casket to the edge of town, to the modest home he and Rosalind built in the 1960s, the place they called home after leaving the White House, and where they are reunited under a willow tree near the pond they fished in for much of their post-presidential life. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
And that's all we prepared for you this Friday, January 10th, 2025. We now leave you with an actually traditional song from Eastern Equatorial State. I'm your host, John Tanzel, coming to you live from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaru, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely weekend. Remember to join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.